Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On August the 29th, 2005, Hurricane Katrina and the resulting levee failures changed everything for many Louisiana residents. As the 10th anniversary of the storm approaches, there are many stories left to tell. We'll hear from Pauline and Stephen Patterson about the role their mid-city bar, Finn McCool's, played in the revitalization of an entire neighborhood. Then, Ann Babin and her brother John Lala share their shocking tale of what happened at Natco, their family business that was located in Uptown New Orleans. And we sit down with food writer Judy Walker to hear the story behind the cookbook that rescued precious recipes saved by generations and lost in the floodwaters, Cooking Up a Storm. But don't worry, it's triumph over tragedy, and everything ends happily on this week's Louisiana Eats. Just 3 years before Katrina, Pauline and Stephen Patterson opened Finn McCool's, a traditional Irish pub that quickly became a popular haunt for residents in New Orleans' mid-city neighborhood. When Finn's was hit particularly hard by the storm, the Pattersons were faced with a decision. Should they rebuild or should they move on? Here, Pauline and Stephen share their Katrina tale and the power of community.
We were going to open that Sunday, and we made the decision Saturday night, and we called the bartenders and said, okay, we are going to close. They've just issued it mandatory. But the girl, we were at the bar on Sunday morning, packing stuff from the bar, heading out, and the bartender came to come to work. And we were like, no. We texted everyone and said, you know, we're evacuating. And she went, oh, okay. But, I mean, that just shows you how...
Yeah, it's a story that's been told 100 times. I'm sure you've heard it. We were in the same boat as everybody else.
Yeah.
We didn't know whether to leave or not. Whenever we decided to, we thought we were only going to be gone for a few
days.
You know, so we thought we'd just come back, you know, mop or cut down the tree limbs that were usually blowing over. There might be a little bit of flooding. You mop it out and you just continue on.
So you left on Sunday?
We left on Sunday.
Where'd you go?
We were with Patrick O'Flaherty. It's so funny because Patrick O'Flaherty had come down to play and he was staying with us. And we drove him to an airport in Monroe. Isn't there an airport in Monroe?
I think so. We went north first.
Yeah, we went north, brought him there because he couldn't obviously get out of New Orleans. And then we met up with my sister and Stephen's brother and we stayed for 6 weeks in Abbeville.
Crowley.
Our friends that own the house in Crowley live in Abbeville. We stayed there for 6 weeks. And Ian McNulty actually sent us a photograph. He got a press pass. And he actually sent that iconic image of Finn McCool's underwater. And it was the most shocking thing, I think.
Yeah, we didn't get any news for the first couple of days. So after the storm, we finally got in touch with one of our bartenders who had stayed in mid-city, and she finally got a text to us. I think it was Thursday night after, and we did, because where we were, we didn't have any TV. We were staying, we didn't have a TV or radio or anything.
Yeah.
So we didn't really know what was going on, what parts of the city were flooded or weren't.
And the people that were showing it on the TV wouldn't say, well, this is mid-city or this is up. Or, you know, they just were saying, oh, New Orleans is flooded.
Yeah, so we finally got the text on the Thursday. So I guess that was 4 days after the storm. And that was, she just said, yeah, the bar is gone.
Oh.
So it gives me goosebumps now just thinking about it.
Yeah. And I think we held it together. Like, we didn't get upset. I mean, not that we were upset, but we didn't cry or anything the whole time that we were away. And we came back. They issued the saying that 70119 could come back. So we arrived at the bar. And I was about to cry. But Stephen actually was really, really upset, and I just like sucked it in, and it was just devastating just seeing everything that, especially because Stephen is the labourer, so much of his actual physicality went into the building. To see it completely destroyed was just so surreal.
So where do you start to rebuild?
We started by throwing stuff
out. The first thing is the gut, take everything out. Like, and it's, again, it's a cliche because it's everybody that we know went through it.
I will say this, and this is quite an Irish thing. The mould, as a real estate agent, like I saw more than my fair share of mould, the mould was absolutely beautiful looking. And if you look at the entrance stone to Newgrange, that's exactly what it looks like. Those triple spirals. I mean, for something that's so devastating and caused the Katrina cough that we all still suffer from, it was destructive but beautiful. And I mean, you just can't...
Before I started ripping out the walls, Pauline insisted on taking pictures of all the mold because she could see the artisticness in it all, and I just wanted to get rid of it, you know, because I knew. But Pauline was looking at it in a different way and could see the rebirth.
Yeah, because the entrance stone to Newgrange has the triskel carved into it, and the triskel is a triple spiral, and it represents life, death, and rebirth. And just to have that so in your face in every single house that you would go in and see, and in Finns, it was actually, if you could, in hindsight, we can say it's cool. But one of the things when we got back was our storeroom. Our orders had just come in for the weekend, and obviously we didn't get to use it. So the storeroom was full of liquor and beer that we couldn't use. But we didn't want to just smash it, so we put it out onto the sidewalk. And the next day it was all gone. It was all gone.
And one of the cool things, you know, because we weren't sure if we were going to rebuild, you know.
Because nobody knew.
Yeah, nobody knew what was going on. And but we got in there and just started, you know, the first day that afternoon, just started taking stuff out. I guess we're into October, towards the end of October when we started pulling stuff out. And by
noon
that day, there was probably 15 or 20 people helping us.
Mm. Yeah.
Customers that have been driving by, people in the neighborhood, they would always drive by and they were saying to us, oh yeah, we've been driving by for a few days. And as soon as we saw the door open, we wanted to come in to make sure you guys were coming back. And we were saying, well, we're not really sure. Are you guys coming back? And they were saying, well, it was all, well, I'm not really, we won't come back if you aren't coming back. There's no point. So it sort of, you know, it galvanized us. Yeah, it made us
a so much stronger community.
Yeah. And, you know, that was the point, I guess, when you realize this is our home. You know, we are Irish. We grew up in Ireland, we'll always be Irish, but that was whenever we realised New Orleans was home for us.
And we had the soccer team that had been training all that summer leading up to a game that they didn't actually get to play. And if it wasn't for Benji Haswell and Stevie Ray and Paul Medhurst, who galvanised everybody and kept them on and this, hardly anybody texted back then, but they used email and text and to basically get everybody together. So after we got everything out of the bar and it was ready now to be insulated and sheetrocked, and we decided the place looked gorgeous for it being in such a desperate condition, and we decided to throw a party. So we invited everybody, and we had gone out to Sam's and we got a load of beer and a load of food, and we set everything up, called everyone. Everybody arrived, and it was so cathartic, and people were crying and hugging each other, and they were like, oh, we have to do this every week, you know, we have to get to. And when everybody left, we had more beer and food than when we started. It was like the New Orleans version of the loaves and the fishes. So we did it five more times before we actually opened on St. Patrick's Day of 2006.
I don't know if you're seeing a theme here. Pauline sees a lot of beauty and destruction and death and misery.
Well, those are kind of Irish traits, aren't they?
Seems to be. Yeah.
Well, yes. You can't feel happy unless you feel miserable. How would you know what happiness is without the flip side of it?
That's fantastic. So tell me about St. Patrick's Day 2006.
Oh, it was amazing. It was Like, we had been working so hard. Like, the bar stools arrived that day, and it was like people were coming in and going, oh, we're ready. And they're going, okay, unwrap your bar stool. Otherwise, you know, don't lean up against that wall, because that wall's
still wet.
We weren't
sure if we were going to open or not, because we didn't have electricity until February of 2006.
Oh my gosh, we had planned
to try and get open as soon as possible. But once we got the electricity back on, we knew then St. Patrick's Day would be the date, March 17th, 2006. And, you know, you were still putting the finishing touches on the place, but it was a great way to
restart
a new beginning, let everybody know that the Irish were still here in New Orleans and this was our day still. And, you know, we wanted to celebrate and celebrate the rebirth of New Orleans.
Pauline and Stephen Patterson of Finn McCool's Irish Pub. Dookie Chase Restaurant in the 7th Ward isn't just a neighborhood hub, but a living piece of history. After Hurricane Katrina's floodwaters inundated the restaurant, it was shuttered for almost 2 years. We invited Leah Chase to tell her story about the aftermath and the restoration of this culinary landmark.
Leah, let's go back and visit those days right after the storm. When did you first come back to the restaurant, and when you got here, how'd you find it?
I kept trying to come, and they wouldn't let me through. And, you know, David, my grandson, was a fireman, and he kept saying, Grandmother, you can't come. I said, I know I can come, but the water was, what, 2 feet in here, 5.5 feet on the bar. It was terrible, terrible. I don't know how my grandkids did what they did in here. They really cleaned out the refrigerators and all that. I had about 50, 60 gallons of gumbo in that refrigerator and all the food, so that was an awful mess to clean out.
And it wasn't just the restaurant you were dealing with. Your home and the homes of most of your family had all been devastated by the storm, too.
Everything. We had no house. We had nothing. Everything was gone. But, and you know, people going to think this is weird, but I say thanks to FEMA. I had a trailer, you know that. So that was funny. Everybody became trailer trash, you know. Oh, well, everybody. Now that's a good thing, because then you won't criticize people for living in a trailer. You will appreciate whatever they can have to live in. And I appreciated FEMA for giving me that space, because I had nowhere to go. And they did that, so that was fun. I even liked the Red Cross meals. But beans, pork and beans and rice and a piece of bread. I was grateful for that. So it worked out.
Well, I remember coming to visit you in that FEMA trailer that was parked right across the street, right across North Miro from the restaurant. And we spent many an afternoon shaking our heads and wondering how we were going to get back in here.
Yep.
So how did the rebuilding here begin? What happened?
As I said, I didn't know where to go or what to do. When I came in here, for some reason, I had no fear. I should have been afraid of everything, but I wasn't. And I just said, I know I could get a broom and a mop and clean. And I got an electrician in. He said, I'll have you some lights in here by tomorrow. I said, well, you don't look like God to me. So I don't know where you're going to get the lights from, but sure enough, he did. He did. He said, now I am my God. I said, close to it. You get the thing. But when we came in here, it was so terrible, Poppy. It was awful. But people came. John Foe sent people to help me. Viking Stove sent people to help me clean. Wasn't that marvelous when you think about it? People came from all over to help me clean up this thing.
Well, I have to tell you, I had the most interesting experience here earlier this week having lunch. And there was a lady who came in, and she said, "Poppy, I don't know if you remember me, but we were here working in the restaurant together when we were trying to help Leah fix it up." Mm-hmm. And it dawned on me how many people in this community now feel like they've got a little piece of themselves here in the restaurant with you.
Poppy, that is, I just cannot get over that. And that's why I'm working so hard, because, you know, I feel I got to pay back. People do something for you, you got to pay back some kind of way. You have to help build a community, you have to do, because people poured themselves in here. You know, all these little ladies from uptown came and cleaned chairs and everything. Bev Church, all those ladies were in here cleaning and polishing whatever chairs I had left. I saved 50 chairs. And they did them to what you see back there now. But people came from all, I just thought that was wonderful, that people would come and offer me money and things to help me get back on my feet. I will forever be grateful. I have never seen that kind of outpouring in my life. Never, never. Because here I am, I'm really not nobody, you know, really. But to see the vision that these people had, to know that if we put this back, that'll be one part of our city that can work and can contribute to building the rest of it. That was unbelievable. I will never, never forget that. I owe so many people, Poppy, I can't afford to die.
Well, Leah, I've told you before that you don't owe anybody anything, because you got this restaurant back open again, and you're repaying everybody every day by just putting food on the table here at Dookie Chase Restaurant. And what was the first meal that you served here at the restaurant when you were ready to reopen?
Oh, Papa, you know, it was our gumbo zab. John Fos came with the gumbo zab, and John was like a saint. Just like so many people around here. He came with a full staff. He said, "Don't bring out anything that you have. I'm coming with everything." And he came with table linens and forks and all the plates and everything and the gumbo zab. And we gave it away. We gave everybody gumbo zab. That was really to let them see that we were trying to come back. That was, I have met so many good people, Poppy. It's just wonderful. You know, it just makes you see how good people are in our city. We have a good city and wonderful people.
Leah Chase, the undisputed queen of Creole cooking.
Now, let me tell you something. Put this on down the street now.
What exactly is that gumbo zerbs Leah Chase was just talking about? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
In the river, way down on the Mississippi River, way in the river, way down yonder in New Orleans, yeah. All right. Hey. All right. Say, way in the river, way down on the Mississippi River.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What exactly is gumbo zerbs? It's a green gumbo served laden with lore. Depending on who you're talking with, it's either vegetarian or chock full of every kind of meat you can think of. The gumbo zerbs that Leah Chase serves every Holy Thursday is of the meat-filled variety. Leah says that in the Creole Catholic community, the gumbo zerbs was the last meal eaten before the Good Friday fasting that leads up to Easter Sunday. Meat-filled or meatless, the superstition surrounding the green gumbo is fascinating. Leah uses collards, mustard greens, turnip greens, beet greens, carrot tops, cabbage, lettuce, and when she can get it, a kind of pepper grass that grows wild on the levees in the spring. no matter what greens go into the pot. Leah says that for good luck, they must always be an odd number. 7, 9, 11. She believes that for every kind of green that goes into the pot, you'll make a new friend in the coming year. And she never fails to laugh and say, you gotta hope one of them will be rich. For a copy of Leah's Gumbo Zerbs recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com or wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Leah Chase's Gumbo Zerbs is real Louisiana Eats. Katrina's impact on the local food industry was far-reaching. In addition to the physical damage it brought about to restaurants and bars, the storm shut down factories and distribution facilities across the state. Family-owned and operated Natco Food Service was included in that number. Ann Babin and John Lala tell the story of the devastation and ensuing revival of their business.
John, I'll let you start.
Obviously, it was a sad time for everyone. Ann and I and my other two brothers and sisters and family, we actually evacuated into two different areas. I was in Folsom, Louisiana, and some of my family went to Shreveport. And the scariest moment is just not being in touch with each other for a couple of days. You know, cell phones, phones just didn't work. So Ann thought the worst of me. I thought the worst of her, thinking that something terrible happened. And I think that was the scariest moment.
So when did you all decide to leave the city?
Sunday morning. We flew out Sunday morning. My parents didn't want to leave, but we ended up having them leave, and we flew to Shreveport Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.
Wow. What about the employees? When did you tell the employees that you were shutting down to evacuate?
I think it was that Friday, Thursday night or Friday. We were kind of proactive. We didn't want to take any chances. Our father, you know, living in New Orleans your whole life, we remember going downtown New Orleans to evacuate when we were kids.
Howard Johnson.
And that's what you did. So we kind of always did a proactive approach to give our staff enough time to get out and let them know. So thank God we didn't have anyone at the facility or nearby.
And what happened at the facility?
Basically, it got vandalized. The majority of it, they went in and put bullet holes and shot bullet holes all through our production facility. All of our desks were turned over. I don't know if people were living in our facility.
I think people were living.
But it was horrific when we walked in.
Right.
There was.
Well, I know we were in three different buildings on Magazine Street, and we called them Building 1, 2, and 3. Building 3, the reefer units that were on the roof, which actually keep all the meat and poultry cold or refrigerated, had actually collapsed into the dry storage. So that was our 10,000-square-foot facility that was, you know, non-operable. Building 2, which was a 7,000-square-foot cooler and freezer, we actually had a generator there. So the generator was actually keeping the refrigeration going. All the product was still good. Ann actually had, and I'm sure, Poppy, everybody has Katrina stories. Ann has a friend that's in the donut business, and Ann and I were actually able to sneak back into the city if we promised to deliver donuts to the airport to the people that were trapped in the city. So Ann and I were able to get with our brother into the city and look at our facility. And like Ann said, people had lived in our facility. They had broken in, and it was just, it was a mess. It really was. And I know Ann and I had tried to talk to numerous people. We had over $1 million of beef, veal, lamb, and pork and poultry. $500,000 of that was still fresh. And we had a generator, and Ann and I, we go back and forth. We would buy 5,000 gallons of diesel, and because of martial law, they would confiscate the diesel, and then the next day we'd go there, the diesel would be gone. And we'd buy another 5,000 gallons of diesel, and then the next day that would be gone.
Who was confiscating it?
We could imagine
but
that.
But what
the,
does that mean
national,
exactly?
I think the national, well, to me,
and
martial
state
law
of catastrophe.
Is.
Catastrophe. Yeah. I think martial law, they can take and do whatever they need to
if
do.
If they need the fuel for their survival, I imagine. Right. We didn't really take a legal deal. We just said, you know what? So at one point, I never forget, we were there and they came and confiscated it while we were there. And we said, look, guys, I know you have to do this. We have $500,000 of meat. So Ann and I actually started donating meat to the National Guard. I never forget, Ann and I went to Harris Casino because they had a big station right there. Mm-hmm. And we were actually cooking ribeyes, steaks for the National Guard and some of the volunteers down there. In fact, one of the volunteers owns Florida-Bama Bar in the Florida-Bama line. And he was out there cooking. And we were just, I never forget, we have pallets, 3,000 pounds of ribeyes on the back of Humvees riding down the street to Poydras Street on Magazine Street to Canal.
I guess you can laugh about it now.
Oh, you have to laugh.
Right.
If you don't laugh, you cry.
That was one of the things that I know worried business owners tremendously was, would their business be able to survive? Was the population going to come back? Where were your customers going to come from? And then you've got the deal with the facility and you've got to move. And how long did it take and how did you figure it all out?
Well, you know, the one thing that Ann and I, when we did finally talk, is there was no option. And Ann and I say, Ann says this, is that Katrina didn't build character. It revealed it. And I hold on to what she said so closely, and we continue to tell that story today because we had so many good family members that worked with us and employees and staff that worked with us that gave us their life. They lost their home, and they were coming to work to help us clean out a stinky, rotten cooler that was filled with meat. And there's still images in my mind of 15 18-wheeler open-top containers down Magazine Street with four USDA officials, all with their badges and vests, inspecting meat as we threw it away because we had to have an inspector there as we cleaned up and threw it away. And they had suits on, mask on, and just cleaning that environment. So when you ask the question, how did you think about it? Ann and I, we looked at each other and said, we have no sales. New Orleans is shut down. We have no revenue coming in. But how can we tell our family member, our employees, you lost your home and now you lost your job?
That is correct.
There was no way we can do that. It wasn't even an option.
That wasn't an option.
We just made do.
Yeah, that wasn't an option. We didn't know how we were going to figure it out. We would meet, a majority of our families had lost their home. We were living in Paulina and we all lived on the same six people opened up their homes to our families. And I just remember we would just be sitting outside going, all right, this is what we're going to do in a notebook. This is how we're going to do it. We're going to try to get in contact with all of our employees. We couldn't get in touch with a lot of them. We were not letting my father's business die. That was our biggest thing, I think. I thought. Not on our watch. It's not going. We didn't know how the hell or what we were going to do to make it better. And there was a lot of tears. I just remember crying, thinking, how are we going to do this? But you know what? That's the drive that my father gave us. You just don't quit. And the integrity that he gave us, not only of NATCO, but like John said, the people. We had 70 families we had to take care of. And that's why we just said we were going to make it work. And we made it work.
So your facility's ruined. You've got to move to a new facility. How long did it take you to get back in business? What was that process like?
August 29th. It was a fun process. We started, my brother Thomas, one of his passions besides the food industry is real estate. I think he gets that from his grandfather who loved real estate. And he was always looking. And so when this opportunity, and I call Katrina an opportunity, which I know is weird for people, but I think and know that Katrina actually helped NATCO grow. And I mean that sincerely. So he had some property and some buildings that he said, guys, I've been looking at this. I need you to go take a look. So Ann and Thomas and Arlene and I went to look at a place in Reserve, Louisiana. And we saw the facility. And I'll never forget, after we saw it, we said, okay, oh my God, it's 90,000 square foot. We're coming out of a combined three buildings, 20,000 square foot. It's too big. There's no way we're going to need this.
And it's a sock company.
Yeah.
Meat and sock.
Yeah, they don't mix. So I'm literally in my car with Thomas, parked on the side of St. Charles Avenue, negotiating with the Port of South Louisiana, which they helped us out tremendously. Amazing. I can't say thank you enough to them.
Yes,
and we negotiated a long-term lease to purchase on the building. All we had to do was go in and demo. Like Ann said, there was a sock company. Yeah, all we had to do. There's a funny story. We didn't know what to do. We're not architects, but we know we had to get back in a quick hurry. So my brother and I, we walked around with a black can of spray.
This was priceless.
And a blue can of spray. And we sprayed and laid out the entire facility with those two colors. And then we got three contractors in and said, okay, we need a price. Everywhere there's a black line, we want a wall. Everywhere there's a blue line, we want a door. And they literally built our facility with no blueprints internally whatsoever. And we were blessed. We had a great team. They actually, from Texas, Daryl, cold storage specialist, they actually lived there. They had a team of 20 people that actually built a makeshift home in the back of Natco while they built our coolers and freezers. And it took us probably about a year to get up and running, but we didn't stop. My brother Thomas and Ann, they rented 10 18-wheelers. Yeah. And we had 18-wheelers parked in front of Natco that he would have to drive up to Natco twice a day to fill up diesel. And those were our coolers and freezers. So we started selling. I never forget, Houston's on St. Charles Avenue was one of our first orders back. And we had no paper to write it on.
Right,
he called me. So I wrote the order on the wall. Yeah. Ann's like, what are you doing? I'm like, Ann, we have no paper, but I have a $5,000 order. I'm writing on a wall so I don't forget it. And it was just, it was fun. It was an exciting time. We all shared the office and the conference room. We had 20 people in there. And you know, it was a stressful time, but we had fun. And we serviced our customers. After Katrina, as we were rebuilding, Ann and I would walk around the French Quarter and hand out bottled water to
people,
anybody we saw,
scrubbing
kitchens and just saying, hey, we're John Lanny with Natco. We want to help you guys. What can we do? And we just kept the word out. We didn't sell them a single thing. They weren't going to be open for 3 months, sometimes even a year.
And we knew they didn't want any steaks. We ended up getting into the pizza business. I would have never thought I'd ever sell a pizza. But people said, people weren't buying fillets or strips or ribeyes, but they were eating pizza. So I said, John, we got to get into the pizza business. So we started selling pizza, and we do a really good job selling pizza now.
We do. We sell
and I thank Katrina for that.
Yeah, we would have never probably gotten into the Italian market.
No.
We bring in tomatoes and pepperoni and cheese and actually the pizza boxes.
Yeah.
So it's we can basically set up a pizza store in there. So just it definitely helped us. Like I said, it gave us an opportunity.
Natco proprietors Ann Babin and John Lala.
When Hurricane Katrina hit the Domino Sugar Refinery, the damage was so extensive that many believed the facility would never recover. In spite of the destruction, the refinery's employees had the plant up and running just weeks later, and it was doing more than just refining sugar. I sat down with Fred Goodrow, head of the refinery's environmental and quality control, to hear their amazing story.
Of course, with a place the size of this, with the people and assets we have, you have to watch hurricanes very closely because you can't just pull the plug on a sugar refinery and walk away from it. You have to plan the shutdown of a place like this for many days in advance. So we do have a hurricane plan. It's something that we practice. We started positioning the plant to prepare for a hurricane around the time that the hurricane had crossed Florida. So we were days and days out ahead of that. I was out of town. I came into here on the Saturday morning, and we were all watching the spaghetti models converge on New Orleans, and that's when we decided to stop the refinery, get the people out, because as you know, hurricane hit on Monday morning. So by Saturday afternoon, we had all of that done. We evacuated everyone out of here. And then we just waited on the what happened. You know.
Did anyone stay?
We did have people that stayed here. Some of the engineering folks stayed. Because we did plan on operating boilers through the storm. We operate and create our own electricity. So the boilers are necessary to create the electricity. So we had a very small crew of people, security people, to stay on and actually spent the storm here.
Tell us what happened.
On Monday morning when the storm hit, the water started to come in from the north. This property has never flooded, to our knowledge, in its history. Didn't flood during Betsy and did not appear to flood during the 1915 hurricane either. But for this one, when the levees broke, the water started pouring in. And so that drove a lot of people from the neighborhoods to our north into the plant. So a lot of people traveled onto the property by boat, by jet ski, by cars before the flooding actually came in, knowing that our land here against the levee is it's actually 10 feet above sea level. It's the highest property in the area. And you know, there was knowledge in the neighborhood that during Betsy people evacuated here and so forth. So you know, for folks who live in this area, they say, you know, if things really get bad, I know I can go to Domino. And they did. So I think we had some 65 watercraft on the property after the water went down. So the boats, they came in on boats and they came into the facility and rode the storm out here, or rode the flooding out at least.
How high did the water get here?
At the front of the property here, which is about 10 feet above sea level, it was about 2 feet deep. But on the back of the property, it was maybe 12 feet deep. The damage to the plant from Katrina was enormous, and insurance companies told us that it would not come back. Well, we had it running in 98 days.
What was the damage? What was the damage that the insurance companies didn't believe you all could come back from?
The damage was mostly electrical. All of our really, really important equipment is located on the second floor and up, things like the turbines and air compressors and so forth. But our electrical infrastructure was down at ground level. So the electrical infrastructure, the motors and the pumps and all of that equipment down at ground level was pretty much destroyed. We lost our raw sugar supply in our raw sugar sheds. We lost all of the product in our warehouse. But it was the damage to the electrical systems that really caused the plant to not be able to restart. And, you know, after the hurricane, there was no natural gas available either. So our boilers run on natural gas. So until that was restored, we really couldn't do much.
But 98 days later, you all were up and running, huh?
The military pulled into New Orleans at that time to help out, and one of the military ships was tied up to our dock. We do have a dock on the Mississippi River, so the military was operating out of here. We had brought in a drilling barge with pods on it for people to live on for the first responders who came in here to assess the damage. And we built a city next door with FEMA trailers, with the help of FEMA and with the help of a lot of people in our ownership, had this place back up and running in just 98 days, which was a fantastic effort after the insurance companies told us it probably couldn't be done. So the employees came back. We housed them next door. We housed their families. We had school bus routes next door. We had laundries next door. We had food brought in. Because there wasn't much happening in Araby in those 98 days after the storm. It was a remarkable time. And the people who were here for that will tell you that it was a life-changing event, and they'll probably never experience anything like that again in their life.
Fred Goodrow of Domino Sugar.
And you don't miss a good thing until it's gone.
When we come back from a short break, we'll speak to Times-Picayune food writer Judy Walker about the project she took on after the storm that ultimately helped New Orleanians get back into the kitchen. Don't go anywhere.
Forest for the trees.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. After the floodwaters receded, many New Orleanians who returned to their homes and kitchens realized they'd lost all their favorite recipes in the storm. Judy Walker, food editor at the Times-Picayune and columnist Marcel Bienvenu, took it upon themselves to make up for this loss. Together, they compiled local recipes into the James Beard Award-nominated book, Cooking Up a Storm, Recipes Lost and Found from the Times-Picayune of New Orleans. To commemorate the 10th anniversary of Katrina, Cooking Up a Storm is being reissued in hardback. I sat down with Judy to reflect on this undertaking and its impact across Louisiana. So tell me, how did Cooking Up a Storm come to be?
We weren't really thinking about doing a cookbook. It all came to be because our readers asked us for it. And so what happened was, as you know, everybody lost all these things in the floods following Hurricane Katrina, and they lost their clippings that they had cut out from the Times-Picayune food pages over the years.
And really, generations of clippings.
Generations of clippings. People lost so much culinary literature in that storm, because I also heard from people who lost their mother's Picayune Creole cookbook with the mother's handwriting in it. You know, just treasures like that. But the newspaper clippings were something that we could at least start to replace. We have a good archive at the Times-Picayune, and part of it's electronic, and part of it we could dig back through the microfiche and the actual files.
Was there one seminal request that made you say,
yes,
Eureka,
yes,
this yes must be done?
Well, it was a lady named Judy Lane, and Judy wrote to us from Talisheek, Louisiana, where she had evacuated to after the storm with her husband. And her letter started off saying that she had lost their home, their business, their cars, and she broke both legs in the storm. And so other people had said, you ought to do a cookbook before this. But when I got that letter, I'm like, oh, we got to do this starting today. So that really was the beginning of the actual project.
And how did you decide which recipes were going in the book?
When we started the recipe restoration project, basically it was just when the food section went back to publishing in the Times-Picayune.
And when was that?
It was October of 2005, after the storm at the end of August. So what happened was, because it was close to the holidays, holiday recipes are ones people don't make all the time, so they tend to rely more on the written recipe. So people started realizing right away that they had lost their holiday recipes.
Mm.
So they started asking for them. So, and we also had asked people, what recipe do you think might be important to the people of New Orleans at this time? And if you have it, share it. And so
I bet
people
the responses
did that.
Poured in.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. I actually got a recipe from somebody that said, I was told never to reveal this recipe. You know, it should only stay in the family, but now's the time to share it.
And of course, you had the great advantage of working with the wonderful Marcel Bienvenu,
who was your
co-author. How did that go?
Well, we were both doing stuff on each end. And so we had emailed each other a lot. And she is so well organized, and I am fairly well organized. So between the two of us, we could get everything down. I had a big list of recipes, and she had a big list of recipes. And so together, we sort of put that all into one thing and said, no, this should go in. No, that shouldn't go in. And then later, the editor had a few suggestions that we went back and put things in.
So let's talk about some of the treasures that people will find between the pages of Cooking Up a Storm. Well, go ahead and let's make everybody hungry. I'm already hungry.
Well, I know this sounds really weird, but one of the recipes was from Maley's, and this gentleman had asked us for it, and it was a whiskey prune pie.
What does that taste like?
Very French.
Very, very French.
You know, in France, they eat a lot of dried plums, as people are trying to market them now.
Yeah, that's so, a better name.
Just unusual things like that that people hadn't, you know, thought of. That was just one person was craving that recipe.
Who was Lady Helen and why are her cheese strots so
don't
special?
You love that? Now, her, I'll have to go back and look up who Lady Helen was, but she we can actually trace. When I became the food editor in 2004, and I took over the files that Dale Curry had left behind, and there were a whole bunch of Xerox copies of Lady Helen's cheese straws. And it was because that was one of the most popular recipes. And so many people had asked for it over and over again that there was a stack of the recipes just to send out to the readers.
So tell me about the recognition that the cookbook received.
We had so many people standing in line at the first book signing, I could not believe. They were waiting for us. People got there early and waited for us to sign it.
Where was it?
It was at the Crescent City Farmers Market.
Oh,
on a Saturday.
The perfect spot.
And it was just, that was really moving. And the things people said to us, and it was just so incredible. At every book signing, we just heard the greatest stories from all kinds of people about what the book meant to them, and through the years, too.
Oh, that's so rewarding. That alone is equals and surpasses the James Beard Award nomination.
Well, and to think that people have said that it belongs on the shelf with the other classic New Orleans cookbooks. And I admire those books so much. And I use those books every day. And to think that ours belongs on there, too, that's just a huge, huge compliment. The reason that I think it's special after I've thought about it for all these years is because the true nature of that book is that it's a public service project and that it was an interactive project. I mean, I always thought about how, okay, so say you're an older person, right? And you didn't suffer any damage after Hurricane Katrina, but you knew that people were seeking these recipes and you couldn't go out and gut houses all day.
But you could,
but you
share
could
your
look
recipes.
Through your recipe file.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
You know, so it was a way of all kinds of people could contribute. So it really was a community project. And that, I think that really came through, and that's what touched people.
And, of course, Judy, people are going to be hearing this the weekend before that anniversary. And I hope that some of our listeners will want to come out and cook with us.
I hope so,
too. On Thursday night at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
I'm very excited.
The Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club. I am so tickled that you and Marcel agreed to be our number one visiting cookbook author chefs at the event.
I can't wait.
See you Thursday night.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Poppy.
Thanks, Judy.
If you're interested in learning more about cooking up a storm, join us on Thursday, August the 27th at the Rouse's Culinary Innovation Center at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We'll be cooking up a storm with Judy and Marcel and eating up a storm, too. Brady's Wine Warehouse will provide the wine pairings. What a night this is going to be! You'll find the link for the tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week for part two of our Katrina coverage when we examine the changing food landscape with Leah Chase sharing her point of view on the storm's 10th anniversary.
Don't keep groaning on the same old, same old. There is a happy side, and everything that you think is bad, look for the good in it. It's just like looking at art. You might say, this is the ugliest thing I've ever seen. Take another look. Take another look.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan's Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding, in the historic Worline Music Building on Canal Street. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Chris Kehoe, and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studio at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.